From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The NBA playoffs begin today. For those who don't enjoy the two-month-long second season, here's a time-saving sports lock. Atlanta Hawks over Denver Nuggets in Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Ahead on Only a Game, a mostly unnecessary NBA postseason preview. Also a new film about the Sonics' desertion of Seattle. And the University of Wisconsin boots the swoosh out of Madison. Also, former NFL lineman Alan Shlomo Vinegrad swaps his helmet for a skull cap and his hip pads for fringes.
I didn't feel comfortable hiding what I wanted to be. Took off the hat, took out the titsits, and here I am, brother.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Texas versus Texas. That's a monumental bout. It's Dallas-San Antonio, though Houston's been left out. Cleveland beats Chicago, Oklahoma drowns, I'll say. Milwaukee doesn't buck the odds, they make Atlanta's day, or so I predict. Joining me now to provide more relevant and probably more accurate predictions about the NBA playoffs is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill. I don't know that I'm going to contradict any of your poetry, though.
I never contradict my poetry. My predictions, on the other hand, are up for grabs. Anyway, it sounds like the six-month-long season has not worn you out. Kevin, you still have some excitement left for the playoffs?
Of course, Bill. As you know, today is opening day in the NBA. Unlike Major League Baseball, spring training lasts 6 months in the NBA, and we go through the tedium of the 82-game season, even though we know basically all the teams that are going to be in the conference finals ahead of time. And now the real games begin, the real intensity, the really bad officiating. It all begins now, Bill.
All right, number one seed Cleveland will face number eight Chicago today. The Cavs and Bulls split four games during the regular season, so is it just crazy to suggest that vaunted Cleveland might be worried about their first-round opponent?
Well, they will certainly take them seriously as a result of splitting the season series, which is bad news for Chicago. I thought it was hilarious that Joe Kim Noah sort of called out the Cavs, like, we want the Cavs in the first round. Well, be careful what you wish for, because as LeBron James put it, you're getting a different kind of monster in the first round, and that series will not go beyond, I'd say, four games.
Atlanta will face Milwaukee, and I think this is an intriguing matchup because both teams have seemed to gain momentum as they have headed into the postseason. Do you agree?
Yeah, and I actually think Milwaukee has turned into kind of an interesting team to look at for the future, certainly with Brandon Jennings at point guard, but the Bogut injury is just devastating for the Bucks. And the Hawks will have way too much Joe Johnson, Josh Smith, and Al Horford for them to deal with.
The Charlotte Bobcats made the playoffs for the first time in their six-year history, and they were rewarded by being paired with the Orlando Magic, the second seed in the Eastern Conference. Doesn't seem fair, does it?
It really doesn't, but the thing about the Bobcats, and it, you know, every once in a while, and I'm a hardcore NBA guy, I got my NBA fantasy team, and Steven Jackson, the Bobcats' leading scorer, was on it. I did not realize until the end of the season that the Bobcats had gone 31-10 at home. I mean, that's not a fluke. That's a legitimately good team. Unfortunately, they're going up against a legitimately great team, and Dwight Howard, surrounded by those shooters, will be way too much for the upstart Bobcats, although congratulations to Gerald Wallace, Steven Jackson, and Ray Felton for a great season.
In the Western Conference, the number one Lakers will face the number eight Seattle Supersonics. I bet the fans in Seattle are really up for this postseason.
Oh, man, still so bitter. They don't get to watch the heir apparent to LeBron and Kobe. Kevin Durant won the scoring title, averaged over 30 points a game, had a 51.4% adjusted field goal percentage when you add in 3 points for three-pointers, shot 90% from the line. We have not seen those offensive statistics since a guy named Larry Bird was playing in the NBA. That said, Lakers will be a little too much for the Thunder, although it will not be a sweep, as our friend Charles Barkley has declared. The Lakers can't focus for more than two games in a row. So I think the Thunder will steal a couple games in that series. Durant's fireworks will not be enough to dethrone the defending champs.
And what do Seattle fans do to express their dismay? Just boycott the series? Watch reruns of sitcom instead?
I think they should go to Safeco and watch the Mariners average one run a game.
There you go. I like the Denver Nuggets coming out of the West to play in the NBA Finals. What do you think?
I have been trying to make that case internally in my own mind all year. I feel like they're a very dangerous team. I've always said that J.R. Smith can win one game almost entirely on his own. So, you know, if you figure Carmelo Anthony's good for a couple and J.R. Smith can steal a game on his own, maybe the Nuggets could upset the Lakers in a seven-game series. But I have to say that I think the emotional toll of George Karl's absence and illness just is going to be too much for that team to push through. And I feel like as much as I would love for the Nuggets to emerge in the Western Conference, I think all my sort of rationalizations will fall by the wayside once the Lakers realize it's winning time.
Kevin, any matchups in the East or the West that we have missed and shouldn't have?
Well, the one, you know, sort of, I guess, the trendy upset pick, which wouldn't be that much of an upset, quite frankly, because of the way the sort of Celtics staggered to the finish line, would be the Miami Heat beating the Celtics in the first round in the Eastern Conference. Dwayne Wade averaged more points per game and more assists per game versus the Celtics than any other team in the Eastern Conference. He averaged 34 a game and 9 assists a game against the Celtics, although the Celtics swept the season series. So they've obviously decided, let Dwayne Wade get his and worry about the other guys. And since the other guys aren't very good, I actually do think the Celtics will limp past the Heat in the first round. And then in the Western Conference, I think the one spot where people think the Mavericks might have gotten kind of a rotten reward for having a great record is they get the Spurs in the first round. But I think the Duncan Ginobili Parker fade into the sunset is in full effect now. And I think the Mavericks, you mentioned the Nuggets, I think the Mavericks are actually the team with the additions of Caron Butler and Brendan Haywood who could give the Lakers a run for their money in the Western Conference.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA for FoxSports.com. You can hear his podcast with John Sally, Spider and the Henchman on iTunes and AdamCarolla.com. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you, Bill.
Last week, the University of Wisconsin in Madison ended its licensing agreement with Nike. Administrators say the sportswear company hasn't dealt fairly with hundreds of workers who lost their jobs after the closing of two subcontractor factories in Honduras. Labor rights activists at the university are now urging other schools to drop their contracts with Nike. Wisconsin Public Radio's Kirk Carapeza reports.
It's outrageous!
What's outrageous?
What's disgusting?
Union busting!
Last week, University of Wisconsin student activists held a rally in the heart of the Madison campus on behalf of 1,800 Honduran workers. A labor rights watchdog group says Nike's subcontractors owe the workers more than $2 million in severance payments. About 50 students marched up Bascom Hill to Chancellor Biddy Martin's office, where sophomore Jonah Zinn delivered a letter urging her to cut the school's contract with Nike. Zinn says getting the Honduran workers paid is not something UW can do on its own.
If 100 universities in the entire world come out to hold Nike accountable, then that really works, and that has precedent. And Nike knows that, and they're scared.
The Workers' Rights Consortium says Nike's subcontractors shut down operations without giving notice to garment workers like Gina Cano, a single mother of two from San Pedro Sula.
One of the ways that this situation has affected my life is that I've had to take one of my two children out of school because I can no longer afford it. I had to sacrifice one of my children's educations for the other. It's had an extremely negative effect on our day-to-day lives.
When the Honduran factories closed, Cano says she and many of her coworkers were left unable to pay rent while others became homeless. Many, she says, are struggling to feed themselves. Since December, Chancellor Martin has repeatedly requested through letters and face-to-face meetings that Nike develop a remediation plan. She has cited the university's labor code of conduct that specifically requires the company to take responsibility for its subcontractors' behavior. Nike has maintained that its subcontractors, not the company, were responsible for paying severance wages. It also said it would continue to provide the workers with additional job training. But a day after the student protest, Martin decided to cut ties. Don Krim is a spokesperson for Martin.
The chancellor feels like they have not done enough. I mean, the factory's closed in January 2009, and we're in April 2010. Right now, there's a lot of people out of work and a lot of families that are going unfed. And we think people working certainly would have been helpful.
Nike refused requests for an interview. In a one-page written statement, officials said they were disappointed by UW-Madison's decision. Members of the university's labor licensing board are now reaching out to other institutions with major athletic programs, including Cornell, Georgetown, Purdue, and Rutgers, as well as the universities of Iowa, Illinois, Miami, Washington, and Montana. So far, none have taken action, but some board members say negative publicity will eventually pressure other schools to follow their example. During last weekend's NCAA hockey title game between Wisconsin and Boston College, hundreds of students gathered at State Street Bratz, a dank sports bar with narrow booths and widescreen TVs. Many students, like Doug Phelps, wore red sweatshirts branded with the famous Nike swoosh. Without taking his eyes off the game, Phelps said he doesn't track the university's licensing agreements.
Not many people pay attention to, like, where our contracts are going or, like, you know, what companies we're leasing our jersey licenses to or what, you know, shoe companies, you know, are buying our football team's cleats or, you know, all that.
Outside on the patio, Elisa Emmerich wore a Grateful red tie-dye T-shirt. She said the fact UW-Madison has more than 500 licenses and struggles to monitor them all doesn't concern most students.
I don't know how they could watch over every single company. That's just too many.
Rick Burden is a sports management professor at Syracuse University. He says UW-Madison will eventually have to find a new maker of the licensed apparel once made by Nike.
And that replacement, as soon as they're announced, will be a company that manufactures offshore.
How can they make sure that that company's clean?
They can't. And so the issue is are they going to chase away this company and that company and the next company? And it's a spiral that's very difficult to get to the bottom of. Nike is an easy target.
A target, Burden says, that's probably not too worried about a single university cutting a $49,000 contract.
And I think they would legitimately be saddened or disappointed that they're no longer affiliated with a great school like the University of Wisconsin, but I don't think that they would be scared. I don't think that's necessarily in their nature.
For now, UW-Madison says it will only reassess a deal with Nike if it takes responsibility for its subcontractors' actions. For Only a Game, I'm Kirk Carapeza in Madison.
Kirk Carapeza just did it, meaning, of course, that he took photos to accompany his story. You can view them on our website, onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. It may be that there's no crying in baseball, but recently there was some proposing in softball. At a high school game in Cincinnati between Glen Estee High and Milford, Glen Estee coach Tim Gregory took advantage of the pregame ground rules conference at home plate to drop to one knee and propose to Milford coach Christy Foster, whom he'd been dating for 2 years. "Yes," said Foster, who might have supposed that her future husband would make of the game an early wedding present, but no dice. Foster's Eagles fell 1-0 to Glen Estee, a loss characterized by some witnesses as heartbreaking. That just doesn't seem right. Folks from all over will come to see. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Sonics, Lies, and Videotape. But first,
we believe each of our players not only has a responsibility to live up to the highest standards on the field, but also to equally high standards off the field. Receiving the support of Pittsburgh Steelers fans all over the world is something that must be earned. I've made it clear to Ben that his conduct in this incident did not live up to our standards.
Thus spoke Art Rooney, president of the Pittsburgh Steelers, on Thursday in regard to his team's quarterback, Ben Roethlisberger, who was accused of sexual assault early last month for the second time since 2008. Rooney suggested that Roethlisberger could, quote, rehabilitate his image through hard work, a theory the Steelers became unwilling to apply to one of Ben Roethlisberger's former teammates, Santonio Holmes, currently serving a suspension for drug possession. Pittsburgh traded Holmes after he had accumulated such charges as disorderly conduct, domestic violence, assault, and drug possession. He most recently was accused of throwing a glass at a woman in a bar and cutting her face. Some observers might have thought such baggage would make even a former Super Bowl MVP unwelcome in any NFL city. As Mike Reese, who covers the NFL for ESPNBoston.com, says, those observers hadn't considered New York.
But the New York Jets stepped up and said, you know what, we're willing to take on this risk. And maybe part of their thinking is we are going into a new stadium. We need to sell personal seat licenses. Maybe we're comfortable at this time with the players we have in our locker room that we can take on someone with a little bit of a troubled background, and possibly he'll fall into line with some of the other strong personalities we have.
The reality of today's NFL suggests that coaches and general managers must constantly weigh how much a player might help them against the likelihood the player will commit a crime or otherwise embarrass and diminish the team. One question they might have to ask themselves is, to what extent does acquiring or rehiring a guy who has run afoul of the law constitute giving that guy a second chance, and to what extent is it the calculated and hypocritical exercise of cynical self-interest? Bob Sherwin, who writes about the Seattle Seahawks for the Seattle Sports Examiner, offers some guidelines for making that distinction.
We all believe in second chances, but there's some guys. I would encourage people to look up Jeremy Stevens. He's got a long, long history of all kinds of problems, sexual abuse problems, assaults with a baseball bat in high school, drunk driving, and he's now with Tampa Bay. The Seahawks finally got fed up with him. This is not a guy with a second chance. This guy is in double figures.
Perhaps a better fit in the second chance category would be Dante Stallworth, who will be playing for the Baltimore Ravens this season. Stallworth's previous team, the Cleveland Browns, released him after he pleaded guilty last June to DUI vehicular manslaughter and served 24 days in prison. Kevin Coward, a columnist for the Baltimore Sun, has been impressed with the sincerity with which Stallworth has expressed regret since the Ravens have allowed him to address the media, and he speculates on how Stallworth's second chance might work out well.
If he contributes to the Ravens, if he's the wide receiver, the downfield threat that they really need, I think all the other stuff is going to be forgotten. That's just the nature of fans. I mean, this was a terrible tragedy. But fans forget even terrible tragedies once the player is doing well and the team is winning. So I don't think he's going to face a whole lot more scrutiny than he already has.
Joining me now is Greg Doyle of CBSSports.com. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, thanks for having me on again. Love it.
Rumors that the Pittsburgh Steelers were willing to trade Ben Roethlisberger ahead of next week's draft were put to rest on Thursday at the press conference. Did the Steelers make the right decision?
Yeah, I think so, because if they trade Ben Roethlisberger, who's won two Super Bowls, by the way, in about 6 years in the NFL, if they trade him, they're basically giving in to the witch hunt. They're basically saying it doesn't matter that he wasn't charged or even arrested for some allegations. It doesn't matter. People don't like him. We're going to trade him anyway. I think that sends the wrong message to the world.
Art Rooney says that he's told Ben Roethlisberger that he'll have to work hard to rehabilitate his image. That's a quote. But if the Steelers win their first three games by a couple of touchdowns and he throws, oh, I don't know, seven or eight touchdown passes and no interceptions, he's rehabilitated, right?
Well, there's two different worlds here. There's the Pittsburgh Steeler world of fans, and there's everybody else. My impression is that Roethlisberger has turned off even the Steeler fans. They're not happy with him. However, your scenario is correct. If the Steelers are 3-0, Roethlisberger has 1,000 yards passing, 10 touchdowns, and one pick, he is rehabilitated in that area code. Now, outside of the Pittsburgh land zone, no, he's not rehabilitated. He's still a serial idiot. And he is a serial idiot. There's no question about that. He's got major stupidity issues and possibly worse. But I don't see trading him, and I really don't see suspending him, because he was accused of something that the police even themselves have said there's not enough evidence here to even prosecute.
Earlier this week, the Steelers did trade Santonio Holmes to the Jets, where he will immediately serve a 4-game suspension for violating the league's substance abuse policy. Did Holmes prove that some off-field problems are just too big or perhaps too numerous to ignore, even if you are the 2009 Super Bowl MVP?
There's a sliding scale here, and for example, the Bengals, that scale doesn't exist for them. They'll tolerate anybody because they're trying to win. When you're the Steelers and you have one and you think you're going to keep winning, your patience is very low, which is why Holmes is gone and why Roethlisberger probably will be suspended.
Holmes has just a year left on his contract, leading some to call his time with the Jets, quote, a 12-game tryout for a longer deal. The Jets have used the same approach with troubled wide receiver Braylon Edwards and cornerback Antonio Cromartie. Is there anybody the Jets wouldn't sign?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking at some point the Jets are going to peruse the Bengals roster and decide, hey, wait a minute, they've got more scumbags than we do, and so they're going to go out and get, I don't know, if Michael Vick is on the trading block, maybe they'll go get Vick, and Paul Hornung, who was one time suspended for an entire year for gambling, maybe he's got some eligibility left. They could get Paul Hornung to return kicks.
You know, being suspended a year for gambling seems like a rather small offense given some of the stuff we're talking about here.
Yeah, isn't that quaint? Pete Rose somewhere is complaining, saying, wait a minute, I'm out of baseball forever. All I did was gamble. I never smacked anybody in the face. I never killed a dog. Pete Rose at this point is looking like a hero.
There is a school of thought that says an NFL general manager cannot hope to build a competitive team if he cares whether a player has been charged, arrested, indicted, convicted, etc. Do you agree with that?
No, I disagree with that. The building an NFL team centers around one position, your quarterback. If you have a great quarterback, other pieces will fall into place, period. The only franchise I can think of that really, really will not tolerate foolhardiness and worse is the Colts. These are very religious, principled people, and I'm talking about the coach, the owner, all that stuff. They will not bring in people they think will embarrass the franchise, which is why the Colts probably are going to end up drafting Tim Tebow, because they value character above all else. And when you have Peyton Manning, who's arguably the best quarterback of all time, you can afford to go after a little bit more of a choir boy element, because Peyton Manning will win you a lot of games because he's that good.
Greg Doyle covers sports for CBSSports.com, and he joins me from time to time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Back in 1957, New York and Brooklyn lost the Giants and the Dodgers, respectively. Since then, there have been lots of other relocations. Here's a representative sampling. Baltimore has lost the Colts, Cleveland has lost the Browns, St. Louis has lost the other Browns and the Hawks, and Seattle has lost the Pilots and, much more recently, the Supersonics. In response to the departure of those Supersonics for Oklahoma City, Jason Reed and Adam Brown have made a documentary film titled Sonics Gate. They join me now from KUOW in Seattle to discuss it. Gentlemen, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey there, how's it going?
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Adam, lots of basketball teams, baseball teams, football teams, and hockey teams have moved from one city to another. What, if anything, distinguishes this move from any other?
There's never been a team with as much success and as much history that is relocated. You know, the Supersonics were in Seattle more than twice as long as any other relocated NBA team. We won a championship in 1979. And, you know, from the 70s all the way through the late 90s, the Sonics had one of the best winning records in the whole league. And they were one of the, you know, flagship franchises out there. So the fact that sort of these backroom deals led to, for the team to be stolen away from Seattle, makes a pretty big statement about the larger state of pro sports in the modern era.
Early in the film, you present NBA Commissioner David Stern talking about what a wonderful building the Sonics have in Seattle after their arena was renovated in 1995. Later, you produce Commissioner Stern in a different vein.
The economics of team ownership at the present time, except in very unusual circumstances, require some kind of public assistance.
Adam, what happened to the home of the Sonics over the course of a decade or so to render it unfit for NBA games and needing public assistance?
After the 1999 NBA lockout and the strike-shortened season, the NBA business model changed to rely a lot more on these corporate suites. And they started pricing regular fans out of the lower bowl area, and they could no longer function off just ticket sales. They had to get these other revenue streams from restaurants, concessions, and so they started needing these giant mega buildings. As in the film, one of the reporters talks about how the new Yankee Stadium is like Disneyland. You know, you could go there and you don't even have to watch the game, and it's just an entertainment palace.
Well, when Clay Bennett bought the team from Starbucks head man Howard Schultz back in 2006, Bennett, who was an Oklahoma City guy, said that he intended to keep the team in Seattle. Do you believe that he ever had any such intention?
Absolutely not. He had been quoted several months earlier in Oklahoma publications saying that he was dedicated to bringing pro basketball to Oklahoma. A big part of this about the whole backroom deals is when Hurricane Katrina forced the Hornets to leave New Orleans for 1.5 seasons, Clay Bennett did his old buddy David Stern a big solid by hosting the Hornets in Oklahoma City. And so Stern had to kind of repay his buddy Bennett for that favor.
But this is the interesting thing, you know, as we saw in the trial, Clay Bennett actually called an economist who basically testified that an NBA team brings no economic value to a community. At the same time, he was simultaneously running a public campaign in Oklahoma City to get them to pass a public subsidy because they could become a big time city and it would help the economy there. So there was this big contradiction going on, and that states a lot about what the NBA is trying to do in terms of pitting cities against each other to try to get an NBA team.
Since you have mentioned the trial, we should get into that a little bit. There was a lawsuit to try to keep the Sonics where they were because they were committed to play there by their lease for 2 more years. Why didn't that work? It sounds like it should have been easy to win.
The city had a very strong case. Basically, what it amounts to is the Sonics were supposed to play at Key Arena through the end of the season, through 2010. They had a lease that had a specific performance clause. Specific performance basically says that if we want to keep the team here, we can keep them no matter what because it's a special entity that can't be replaced monetarily. But Clay Bennett hired a very skilled attorney named Brad Keller. They came up with a lot of ways to paint the city in a bad light, and they kind of swayed public opinion that the city was losing. They kind of embarrassed our mayor, Greg Nichols. And while publicly he said for months and months and months, this is not about money, we're going to keep the team here no matter what for 2 years, about an hour before the judge was going to issue her ruling, a press conference was called duly in Oklahoma City and Seattle, and the mayor said he accepted a settlement agreement, basically giving up the team and the history for $45 million.
Seattle's fans seem to feel that they could influence the ownership of the Sonics. You filmed several of their demonstrations, including one in which the fans were addressed by one of their favorite former Sonics, Gary Payton.
Save our Sonics! Save our Sonics!
This team should not move.
Right,
I don't think
Gary.
It's going to move.
Yeah.
And I want to raise my jersey in the rafters here in Seattle.
Jason, as you collected material for the film, did you get the impression that anybody connected with the team during the Bennett years was paying any attention to the fans?
The moves they were making were both good for the future, as you see the Oklahoma City success, but they are also not in the best interest of the fans. To trade, you know, we drafted Kevin Durant, who we see has just won the scoring title. You know, they never let him connect to the community. And it's tough. They traded, you know, Ray Allen and Rashard Lewis, who are two superstars who were here and were connected to the community. So we got Kevin Durant. We could have kept those two guys, and the team probably would have made the playoffs and would have had that connection to the community. But they shipped everyone out. We started losing the identity of the Seattle Supersonics, and that in turn kind of turned off the community to the team.
I'm talking to Jason Reed and Adam Brown, who made the film Sonics Gate, and you're listening to Only a Game. You included in your film several passionate fans. Certainly the most articulate among them is celebrated author Sherman Alexie, who comments on what the loss of the Sonics means to him and to Seattle.
It is death. I mean, it's been a year and a half of a funeral, a wake. And the weather is depressing. The winters are depressing. They're gray and monotonous.
Did you have to seek out Sherman Alexie, or did he learn what you guys were doing and come find you?
We sought him out, and he was somebody who we knew we had to have in the film just because he's so articulate and so passionate, and he speaks for people and articulates things in a way that nobody else could. One of his friends forwarded him the trailer that we'd put online, and he finally said, okay, I got to do this.
The overall impression created by the film is that Clay Bennett, the current owner of the former Sonics now playing in Oklahoma City, is a shameless liar. Are you at all concerned about how he's going to react to Sonics Gate?
No, not really, because we're using his own words and the things he said. He said 9 months before he bought the team that he was looking to buy a team to move them to Oklahoma City.
And I think it's important to note that we did reach out to Clay Bennett. We reached out to David Stern. We reached out to Howard Schultz. We reached out to Greg Nichols, and they all declined our interview requests.
Do you intend Sonics Gate as a warning to fans in cities where teams are demanding now or may soon be demanding new arenas or stadiums?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it already, and, you know, a lot of things are going to change in the next year or two. We're going to find out a lot about the NBA business model with the collective bargaining agreement coming up. We could see another strike-shortened season here after next season in 2011. We're seeing it in Sacramento. They've been trying to get a building there. Indiana, New Orleans, New Jersey is having some issues. So this is definitely a warning for fans of other teams. You know, no team is truly safe. If a team like the Sonics with 41 years of history and Jack Sikma and Gary Payton and Sean Kemp and Spencer Haywood and all these Hall of Fame guys can move just like that, then, you know, the Knicks could move or the Celtics could move or any of these major teams could move.
Jason Reed is the director of Sonics Gate. Adam Brown is one of the film's producers. They joined me from KUOW in Seattle. Jason, thank you very much for speaking with me.
All right, thanks a lot for having us on.
And Adam, thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Bill.
Sonics Gate, Requiem for a Team, will be screened in New York City April 28th through May 1st. The film is also available online, and you can link to it at our website, onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
It is a record no team would want, but I suppose it has given the club a bit of attention. This understatement comes courtesy of Addy Heath, who manages AFC Aldermaston, which had lost a record 40 soccer games in a row before holding Warminster Town to a 1-1 draw last weekend. It was the worst losing streak in British soccer history. Morale has been good, Mr. Heath said, but who does he think he's kidding? Unable to pay their players last season, his club lost 10 starters to a rival team over the summer. This season, snow rendered Aldermaston's home ground unplayable for a month. They'll be relegated, of course, demoted to a lesser league, and will spend next season in the Hampshire Puma League, where there is every chance they'll be devoured.
With a big, strong heart to a long, steep hill, we may get there with a smile.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, what a former NFL lineman does on any given Sabbath. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Pittsburgh Steelers held a press conference Thursday to announce that they have not traded Ben Roethlisberger and that the team would work with the commissioner's office to determine an appropriate punishment for the star quarterback, and that now everybody should just watch the NFL draft. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, exactly, except that it is now time for the Pittsburgh Steelers in the National Football League to demonstrate their social conscience, so he will be suspended for a whole bunch of time at the beginning of the year. Whether or not you believe this will help at all is, of course, up to you.
Casey Fitzsimmons, late a tight end with the Detroit Lions, retired this week, and he said the team had advised him to do so because of the concussions that he had suffered. Is this evidence of a kinder, gentler NFL ethic?
Well, considering that he probably would have been traded for draft picks in an earlier era, yes. I think that, you know, if the team actually did advise him to quit because of concussion, you know, concussion-related problems, then good for them. I will know that the league has turned the entire corner, though, when they see them making the same suggestion to a starting quarterback.
Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones said on Thursday that he was using, quote, a sarcastic term of endearment when he said ex-Dallas coach Bill Parcells, quote, isn't worth a bleep. Gee, if that's how Jerry Jones talks about his friends, I wonder how he characterizes his enemies.
Well, more accurately, he was using a term of sarcasm in a very strange kind of way in
yes.
a place where they serve grown-up beverages. I don't know how I feel about this. Are we really just an entire nation of informers now? Are we just a country of stool pigeons?
Every cell phone has a camera.
And every cell phone now has a video camera?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to live in that world. I really don't. I mean, the top of a mountain's looking better and better.
The New York Yankees got their championship rings this week. One of the day's loudest ovations went to Hideki Matsui, currently a Los Angeles Angel of Anaheim. Doesn't seem quite fair that he should be there and not in New York anymore, does it?
Well, you know, times being what they are, he took the money. But he was the World Series MVP. His former teammates came out and embraced him. It was a very, very nice moment.
Boston slugger David Ortiz is being sued by rapper Jay-Z and a business partner who claim that Big Papi named his Dominican nightclub after the rapper's 40-40 nightclub. Since neither Ortiz nor Jay-Z have actually hit 40 home runs and stolen 40 bases in a single season, maybe they should both be sued by Jose Canseco, A-Rod, Barry Bonds, and Alfonso Soriano.
Well, why do I think that at least one of these 40-40s refers to, like, a bottle of malt liquor and not the the baseball statistics
imagine.
That were under question?
I don't know. Lakers coach Phil Jackson was complaining this week about Kevin Durant, the youngest scoring champion in NBA history. Jackson said, I think referees are treating him like a superstar. He gets to the line, meaning the foul line, easy and often. For those remarks, Jackson was fined $35,000. I don't know how he's going to come up with $35,000.
Well, more to the point.
He only makes $12 million a year.
More to the point, this is a guy who's coached in order Michael Jordan, Shaquille O'Neal, and Kobe Bryant.
Mm.
He's got no room to talk about. His apparent argument is that Kevin Durant isn't old enough yet to get these calls. Well, you know what? Kevin Durant is arguably the third best player in the league right now. Get over it, Phil.
NBA broadcasters get to vote on who wins the Rookie of the Year award, Charlie, except for Del Curry, who calls games for the Charlotte Bobcats. How come Mr. Curry was disenfranchised?
Because his son is the leading candidate. Steph Curry, who, of course, was a star in the NCAA tournament last year, playing for Davidson, getting them to the Final Eight, has had a terrific rookie season, a great last month of a terrific rookie season, and now poor Dell doesn't get the vote. I think they should count the ballots.
I don't think.
If the guy is winning, they should let Dell vote.
Dell wouldn't ever let that sway his choice.
Well, even if he would, let him cast the vote like a day after you've counted all the other ones.
The University of Oregon wants to pay their next men's basketball coach $3 million a year. Why didn't anybody want the job?
Because I think, at least in part, because it's a tough job to win at, although it didn't used to be, it is now. And secondly, if somebody is offering you $3 million to take the Oregon job, you better win the next day, because otherwise you're going to get fired and they're going to find some other sucker.
These Stanley Cup playoffs might be remembered for the upsets, Charlie. After a night of upsets on Wednesday, the number one seeded Washington Capitals fell to the lowly Montreal Canadiens on Thursday. I never thought I would say lowly Montreal Canadiens, but what's going on?
More to the point, the Capitals and Alexander Ovechkin have things to prove in the playoffs now. Ovechkin was held without a shot by the Canadiens, who aren't all that good. And this will be the second year in a row now where they've struggled in the playoffs. They need to win this series easily.
Is it safe to say that members of the Vancouver Canucks will enjoy the playoffs more than at least some of their opponents will?
Well, can I say right now that if you look at the NHL standings, that the Vancouver Canucks are the quote-unquote leading scoring team in the league? Hey-o! Alain Vigneault was asked by a health reporter from the Vancouver newspaper how he advises his players in dealing with their daily routine of training, recovery, diet, sex, and other activities that they do every day. To which Vigneault replied, we do sex every day? Zut alors!
This week, 47-year-old Evander Holyfield said, quote, I'm going to be the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. You suppose he's forgotten that he's already done that?
I think he's probably forgotten how to tie his shoes at this point. The idea that anybody sanctions this guy to fight at the age of 47 after the beatings he's taken is disgraceful. The problem is, he probably could become the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. I just hope nobody notices.
We have another athlete to add to the list of people trying to master more than one sport at the highest level. How do you like the chances of pro golfer Jerry Rice?
Well, he's moving into the nationwide tour. I mean, it's not like he's stepping out into the U.S. Open. He's 47 years old. He's been golfing seriously for 20 years, which has actually escaped me. I had no idea about this. And he's also going to host the tournament he's playing in because his foundation will receive the proceeds. Good luck to him. I mean, it's better than trying to be the heavyweight champion when you're 47.
Chick Hearn, who died 8 years ago, was the voice of the Los Angeles Lakers for 42 years. He turned in a string of 3,338 straight broadcasts without a miss. The Lakers will honor him with a statue, and it is perhaps the most fan-friendly sports-related image of all time, don't you think?
This is really terrific. They're putting up the statue, and of course it will be Chick sitting at the usual broadcast table with his headphones and talking into a microphone. And they've left a seat next to him so you can sit down and be his color analyst,
isn't
which I think
great?
Is really neat.
I love it. And finally, Charlie, a fish story, the moral of which is if you're going to cheat in a bass fishing tournament, make sure the prize that you're trying to win isn't worth more than $20,000. You want to explain that?
Well, yeah. This guy, Robbie Rose from Garland, Texas, decided he would put a lead weight into a bass during the fishing tournament in an attempt to win it. He got caught. He pled guilty to attempted theft over $20,000 because the prize was $55,000. He's got 5 years probation, 15 days in jail, and he loses his fishing license for 5 years, which I suspect is the harshest part of the punishment. What really surprised me was that he turned in the fish, and then he went to the polygraph area.
Yeah.
They give you lie detectors in these bass tournaments.
Listen, there's a $55,000 boat at stake here. They don't kid around.
And not just that, but they noticed that when they put Robbie's bass into the tank, it sank to the bottom.
That was the clue. That tipped them.
You can't put much past the people who are officials in professional bass tournaments, I'll tell you that.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I got a big bass on the line, but it don't mean nothing at all.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org.
My baby usually come with me whenever I wet my line. I say my baby right there with me whenever I wet my line.
Alan Vinegrad was an offensive lineman in the National Football League during the late 1980s and early 90s. Not long after his football career ended in 1993, the 6'5", 275-pound Vinegrad turned to Orthodox Judaism. He's since made a niche for himself as a motivational speaker. This weekend, he'll be inducted into the National Jewish Sports Hall of Fame on Long Island. Only a Game's John Kalish caught up with Vinegrad recently, and he has this report.
His website boasts that Alan Vinegrad leaves his audiences spellbound, but sometimes those audiences can be, well, limited.
Welcome to Jewish Community Radio.
Good morning, good morning.
Alan, you have an incredible story.
Incredible run, actually. No pun intended.
Though they may be relatively few and far between, professional Jewish athletes are eagerly celebrated on Jewish radio programs and in Jewish newspapers because they refute the stereotype of the Jew as weakling or nerd. And so Vinegrad is being embraced big time in the Jewish community. He uses his Hebrew name Shlomo when he talks to Jewish audiences about his newfound life of strict religious observance. On a frigid winter night, several dozen people gather in a lavishly decorated suburban home in northern New Jersey. The Saturday evening speaking event was organized by a local Lubavitch Hasidic group, so the festivities begin with a rabbi conducting a brief ceremony marking the end of the Sabbath.
Cain Tielanu Cain.
Cain.
Cain Tielanu Cain.
Cain.
Cain Tielanu Cain.
Then it is Shlomo's show. If he wasn't 6'5" and dressed in a conservative business suit, he might be mistaken for a member of ZZ Top because his beard is that long. Vinegrad wears a yarmulke, and the ritual fringes known as tzitzit hang from his waist. His half-hour speech includes a recounting of his family's move to Miami in 1972, the year the Miami Dolphins went 17-0 and won the Super Bowl.
And as a 9-year-old kid, they became my life. The Miami Dolphins were my life.
The enthusiasm he had for the hometown football team stood in marked contrast to the dread he felt for Hebrew school.
It wasn't fun, it wasn't inspiring. However, I learned enough to become a bar mitzvah boy, and like many of you in this room, the bar mitzvah was what? The exit out of Judaism. It wasn't the entrance into Judaism. Our parents said, okay, you're a bar mitzvah boy, check, and as a family, we moved on.
Vinegrad was a mediocre football player in high school. His mother altered his high school football resume so it had him running the 40-yard dash in less than 5 seconds. This by any means necessary spirit was in evidence when he tried out for the East Texas State University football team. The coach wanted to make sure Vinegrad was as fast as the resume claimed.
He said, Alan, you ready to go? I said, yes, sir, coach. He says, fine. He said, put your hand on the line over here. I'm going to go to the other side of the gym. When I get to the other side of the gym to that other line, go ahead and take off. I said, yes, sir, coach. I get behind the line. Coach Hawkins takes off and goes 2/3 of the way down the 40-yard dash line, and I take one giant step in front of the line. And I take off, and I run a 4.9 in the 39-yard dash.
Vinegrad got a full college scholarship that day to East Texas State University. He was the first Jew many of his teammates had ever met, and he credits the offensive lineman at the university with instilling in him a fierce competitive spirit. After college, Vinegrad tried out for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the Houston Oilers, but didn't make either team. He wouldn't give up, and in 1986, Vinegrad won a starting position on the offensive line of the Green Bay Packers. As his first season in the NFL began, Vinegrad got a call from a Jewish businessman named Lou Weinstein.
I have no idea who Lou Weinstein is. So I take the phone message note, I go into the players' lounge, I dial up Lou Weinstein, and this old man in Green Bay answers the telephone, hello. I said, is this Lou Weinstein? He says, it's Weinstein. I said, I'm sorry, from the East Coast. I thought it was pronounced Weinstein. He goes, it's Weinstein. Who is this? I said, this is Alan Vinegrad of the Green Bay Packers. Oh, Alan, thank you for calling me.
Vinegrad spent the Jewish High Holy Days with Weinstein's family. It was his first time in a synagogue in a decade. Weinstein helped Vinegrad find an apartment and buy a car and instilled in him an appreciation for the obligation Jews have to reach out to their fellow Jews. After 5 seasons with the Packers, Vinegrad went to play for the Dallas Cowboys. In addition to the generous signing bonus the Cowboys offered, the move was attractive because Vinegrad would have a better chance of finding a Jewish wife in Dallas. It turned out that he didn't play much as a Cowboy, and Vinegrad saw no action in Dallas's Super Bowl victory over the Buffalo Bills in January 1993.
Third and goal at the 10-yard line. Aikman, a draw to Smith. Coming left, breaks through, cuts to the 5. Turning at the 1. Touchdown, Evan Smith! Touchdown, Cowboys!
Vinegrad retired after the Super Bowl. When he speaks professionally, he's been known to show off his Super Bowl ring.
If you like this ring, I got to show you something that most people think is cooler than the ring. Emmitt Smith bought a Rolex watch for all the offensive linemen. To Alan V, thanks for the 1,563 yards, 1991 rushing title, Emmitt Smith.
Wow.
Vinegrad speaks about 45 times a year to businesses, sports groups, colleges, and Jewish organizations. His Jewish audiences range from the observant to the secular. Mark Rosen is an engineering consultant who attended Vinegrad's talk in Wyckoff, New Jersey.
The strength that made him a professional athlete is also the same strength of character that allowed him to go this path.
But Vinegrad's path to Orthodox Judaism has had a few bumps. In 2003, he put a yarmulke on during a flight to Israel. After 2 weeks in the Holy Land, he started to wear tzitzits. The ritual fringes are a garment Orthodox men wear underneath a shirt. They hang down from the waist outside the pants. At first, when he returned to the United States, Vingrad hid his yarmulke under a baseball cap and kept his tzitzits tucked inside his slacks.
I didn't feel comfortable hiding what I wanted to be.
And so,
took off the hat and took out the tzitzits, and here I am, brother.
Alan Vingrad will be inducted into the National Jewish Sports Hall of Fame on Long Island this Sunday. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from Doug Patterson at KUOW in Seattle. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Kirk Carapeza's Wisconsin versus Nike photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on our Facebook and Twitter pages at Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from Greg Doyle, who waxes poetic about the changing of the seasons.
Ohio is 80 degrees. We went from a brutal winter right into the middle of summer. I got screwed out of spring. I want to know what happened. Where's spring?
Why, it's ever in your heart, my friend. Has writing about sports robbed you even of that necessary illusion? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, LendingTree with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.